Testing 1, 2, 3. This is August 13th, 1980, and we're at the home of Al and Jeannie Wright, working on the biography series.
I'm not really sure, but I think in some cases they do that, yeah. But I think that's the wrong way to do it. I think they need to put them into a fresh stream, you know, that they can't spawn in, because there's only very few places they can spawn and survive. You know, like I've flown these fish surveys, you know, for years, and they have to have fresh water coming up, and it can't freeze in the winter. And like the chums in, say, at Big Delta, they go up maybe a mile up the Delta River, and as far as they can go, because the glaciers and freezes above that. And so they spawn right in that area, and there's water bubbling up all year round there, and it never freezes solid. And they have to have this water coming out of the ground to agitate the eggs to keep them fresh. You know? But if they went into, say, Wood River, the salmon, there's no place like that. There's no springs coming up, so they can't survive. And that's why there's no fish go up there, because it freezes shut, it glaciers and freezes shut. So they can't go up there. So if they took these eggs from any place, hatched them, put them into the Wood River, let them go down, let them come back into the Wood River, and then caught them again, it'd be a whole separate run of fish. See? And they wouldn't go up the Big Delta. They'd go to Wood River, because that's the way they're programmed.
But would that involve having to catch every single fish that came back up in the Wood River?
Well, they just catch whatever they needed.
And just let the rest?
Let the rest go. They'd strip out as many as they want.
So what do they do then if they can't spawn? They just get lost?
They just die. They'll spawn, but they won't do any good. Their eggs won't hatch. See, because they might find a place in the gravel and they might spawn, but the eggs won't hatch because they'll die, you know, because they'll freeze up, they'll glacier over and freeze up, or they'll be, you know, they just can't make it.
Well, so you've flown fish surveys, right?
Yeah. Well, like in this area for king salmon, there's some go up to Chena. Very few go up to Chattanooga. It used to be a lot go up to Chattanooga, but when the mining started, they ruined, you know, half the spawning ground.
How'd they do that?
By running mud in them.
Silt?
Silt, yeah. And tore them up, and they, you know, just destroyed them. And the same in Goldstream. There used to be salmon come up Goldstream. But with the mining, it just got rid of it all. But now there's a few go up to Chena, and there's quite a few go up to Good Pasture and the Salcha. A lot of fish go up, kings go up to Salcha. And in the upper Tanana, those are actually the main streams for the king salmon.
How about Kantishna or Tolkien?
There's no kings go up there. Lots of chums. Toklat has got a lot of chums in it. Nenana River gets a lot of chums. And they go, like in the Toklat, they go up as far as Knight's Roadhouse. And that's where most of them spawn, right in that area. And see, and then in the Nenana River, they up around Clear, they spawn. And then you go on up the river to there's a lot of chums spawn right in the Tanana River between between Harding Lake and Delta. There's about three or four areas that they spawn in there. And then the biggest part of them spawn right in the mouth of the Delta River, you know, right up from the big Delta River from the Tanana, just within about a mile or so of the mouth. And then there's, you know, other ones going up. A few go on up further, but the bulk of them, that's where they go, that come up the Tanana. And up the Yukon, when they, the ones that, you know, a lot of them go up the Kayakut. Mm-hmm. But then after they leave there, the bulk of them go up the Tanana or up the Yukon, and they go into the Chandler River. There's a lot of fish spawn in there, chums. No king spawn in there. And up the Salmon River, the Black River, a lot of them go. And then, but there's kings that go all the way up into the Yukon, way above Whitehorse. You know, and actually there's quite a few go up there in various streams and in the White River.
The salt are all dogs, aren't they?
The what?
In the salt, there's all dogs that go in there, not chums.
The Salt River?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're chums. So see, a dog is a chum. They're all chums. Well, what they call silvers on the Yukon is a chum, but it's a different kind. It's got red meat instead of white meat. Like a, well, we call a dog salmon. It's got the white meat, and they're not very good eating. But what they call a silver is looks basically the same. Only he's a sleeker, in better shape than the, what we call a dog, and he's got pink meat or red meat.
Is the idea that fish just go to different places to spawn?
I think so, yeah. That's what they tell me. They're all basically the same fish, but they're just, you know, going to different place so they're in better shape.
Well, what's one of these spawning beds look like from the air?
It's a place that's, you know, where water's coming up out of the ground. It's a spring. And the water, you know, is burbling up all over in the... Under the water, you know, under the riverbed. Yeah. And you can see where the fish are hollowing out little nests with their tail, you know. They just brush a little hole out, and then they lay their eggs in that. And then the males fertilize them in the same place, and then they stay there and guard them and run any other fish away, you know, from that area until they die. And then they just float off down the river. And a lot of times another fish will come along and take it over, chase the other one out, you know, if he's got more aggressive or something. But you can see all these fish laying in these areas guarding their nests. And then once they, you know, die, they stay there until they die. You know, they just use up all their whatever they got when they leave the ocean, and then they die and float off, and then... After that, the thing just takes its own course.
So, does it really look like there's a big bunch of fish in the river? You can see them.
Oh, yeah. You can see them. There'll be big schools of them in these places. And they're all just milling around in there, you know, vying for position. And like when we do the count, you know, you get in a stream and the biologist generally has a counter with him, you know, and he'll count. What you do is you take a school, you find a school of fish, and you fly around until you count every fish in that school that you can count. You know, you're going to make mistakes, but basically you're going to get all of them. So you say there's 100 fish in that school. Okay, then you find another one and you know, compare it. And you try to count. And then finally you learn by looking at a school this size, there's 100 fish or there's 200 fish or there's 500 fish in a school. See? So then when you fly up the river to count them, you start right at the mouth and you make every bend in the river. So you make every turn and fly as slow as you can in about maybe 200 or 300 foot altitude or whatever the weather conditions, you know, that are there allow you to fly. And so you follow the stream, and then he sees a bunch of fish and he punches the button for 100 or 200 or 10 or, you know, or 500. Whatever he figures is in that school, and you'll be going up the river, and there'll be a little school here. And then you go another half a mile and there'll be another little school, and then you go maybe a mile and there'll be a big school, and in between there might be a few scattered fish, you know, and you just kind of throw them in as a lump sum and just follow the river right from the from where it, like say we're doing the Salcha, right at the mouth of the Salcha where it runs into the Tanana, and then you follow it right on up to the head where there's no more fish. In some places they won't go all the way up, because most all those streams will glacier way up, and there'll be a place to where they'll stop and you go up and there won't be no more fish above that. Could be halfway up the stream or a quarter of the way up or three quarters or whatever. See, like in the Chandelar, right there below Venati is the biggest spawning ground. And then there's a few go up further than that, but you know, I'd say 90% of them are spawning down below Venati. And then in the Xinjiang, the same way. You get, there's a guy that traps, his name is... can't think of it right offhand, but just below his cabin is a big spawning ground. There's thousands of fish right in that area. They're about a mile long stretch. And that's where all these springs come up and all the fish spawn in there. You go above there and there's, you know, there's a few other little places on up, but the bulk of them are right there.
How about in the Toklat?
In the Toklat, there's they go up as far as Knight's Roadhouse.
Is that where most of them
are? Most of them are in the little slough that goes off, right? It forks off right at Knight's Roadhouse. And then out in the river from there down for about, 5 miles. There's a few little areas down in there that most of them spawn, but that's where the bulk of them are, right in that area. And in the Nenana River around Clear. And then on the Kantishna, they go up into what they call a place called Diamond.
Right.
And it's, you know, up on the Bearpaw River. And there's a spawning ground up in there where most of them spawn.
I'm doing those surveys. Is the pilot also counting, or is there another person in the
flight? No. And they have a biologist that does the counting. You're supposed to just do the flying. Of course, you count too, but it's it's really a tough job flying those surveys, because you're making all these bends, you know, every bend. You're trying to fly as slow as you can go. So you really got to concentrate on what you're doing. And you don't have that much time for counting. You have to just fly the airplane, let the biologist do the counting. If you try to do it too, then you're going to be in for trouble, because unless you're flying a helio courier. That's why all these cubs are always augering in, you know, on these trips. That's what they do. They just get carried away and they're not watching what they're doing, and they make a tight turn and auger it in. But I really like the helio for that, because there ain't no way you're going to auger that in, you know. It can't. It's impossible.
Why is that impossible?
The way the airplane's built. It's stall-proof and spin-proof. And see these slats come out on the leading edge. And when them slats come out, banging out, you know you got to do something. And you got about another 10 miles an hour to do something about it. Where in these, you know, conventional-type airplanes... You know, if you stall, I mean, you're stalled, you're spinning in. And from that low an altitude, you don't have any chance to recover. You just can't do it. And see, the helio, it'll just straighten out, and your nose will never go in. It'll always stay up, so you'll fall flat. And if you do get into that predicament, which is almost impossible, you'll just fall flat into the trees or anything, and the chances of you getting hurt are pretty remote. In that, but if you're in a Cub or a 180 or something, you're dead.
It sounds like you probably come pretty close sometimes.
Well, I've never come that close. I've had a few close ones, yeah.
Well, I imagine that for flying these surveys, they probably get all different kinds of pilots to do it.
Yeah.
But some pilots are probably a little more interested in what's on the ground. You know? And if the guy was trapped in the same country, he might look real careful at what it was they're surveying.
Well, you know, like most of these biologists, they get to flying with one pilot. And they don't want that. That's the only guy they want to fly with because they get confidence in him. See, and so they want to stay with him, and they'll do a pretty near anything to. And see that for a while, the state bought all their own airplanes, and their biologists flew them, and they had such a big problem. They killed so many people that they went back to chartering it done, because they figured the biologist is too interested in what he's doing. He's not paying any attention to his flying. See.
Like
which was true. No, they had two, but the thing is that he's still too interested in his project. See? Well, and the pilot, his main and only job is to fly the damn airplane, see, and take care of it. And he doesn't care whether there's two fish or 100,000 fish, but the biologist does. And it's two different jobs.
We're talking about a little bit of fishing that I really like to get out of the tape.
Yeah, I know. That's why I snuck away and got the tape recorder without saying anything.
But you think we can backtrack it?
I'd like to hear how this is doing because the monitored level is really high. Okay.
Should I plug in? Okay, you plugged in? You're talking about. Years ago when, of course we'll work our way up to the present, but years ago when Ira Wiesner was buying fish for import, something about what his operation was there. I wish we'd been taping it then, but maybe just tell me all over again.
About how he ran his cannery?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, I don't know whether he built it or somebody else, but he built this... coal storage, you know, ice house into the hill. He dug it back in. It was probably about, 12 feet wide and 30 feet deep back into the hill. And then he built bins on the side of it and put ice in them, blocks of ice, you know, that he cut out of the river and built these ice bins out of it. And he had to a double door on the front of it, insulated doors to get in and out. So when he was going into it, he'd open one door and close it, and then open the other door and go in so he wouldn't lose the refrigeration. And when he ran his cannery, he'd taken, when the king salmon first started running, he'd buy them from anybody that'd bring them in and sell them to him. He'd take them back and put them in these ice bins. And then they'd keep, see, until he got enough to start his cannery up. Because he didn't want to start up for a few fish. So he'd wait till he got enough fish to where he figured he could afford to start running the cannery. And then he'd hire mostly women from Rampart to come in and you know, cut the fish and put it in the cans. And they sealed it all by hand. And he had the steam cooker and he did it. He did a real good job of canning them, and then he'd sell them, you know, up and down the Yukon River.
So and, now, did he have the same kind of a sealer like you got over there?
Basically, yeah. Yeah. And it was a better grade than we got, you know. They made better stuff in those days. But that's basically how he did it. And he had a big, you know, steam pressure cooker. You know, commercial type cooker where you could maybe cook 20 cases of fish at one time. And he had a good business going, you know, and selling these fish up and down the river. And until the health department or whichever government agency is trying to put you out of business came over and put him out of business. And, you know, that's basically how you operate.
No boxes.
No, never heard anything like that. I mean, those cans were examined can by can. There was no chance of botulism in that, you know, because they check each can that come out, make sure they're sealed.
So yeah. Now, when he put those fish in cold storage, they weren't cleaned? Or...
No, he just put them in whole, and then they'd clean them after they were ready to take care of them.
So how many fish do you think would
build up? Well, heck, I'd say he'd probably have at least 200 or 300 fish before he'd start his cannery up.
And so how many times in the season would he start running?
Well, if they were coming fast enough, he'd can them right off. But the first batches, you know, that he couldn't, you know, they come slow. He'd just put them on that ice until he got enough to start the cannery, you know. And then once the fish started running heavier, then he'd can until they were slacking off again and then quit. But he kept, you know, all the stuff in that place that he, you know, grocery, he ran the store there, and he kept any perishable stuff he'd keep in this ice house that he had. And, you know, nobody has those anymore, and they're the cheapest way to refrigerate anything in the world, you know, because they don't cost anything. Just leave them open in the winter when it's 50 below, and man, they're cold all summer. And it doesn't cost a damn penny to operate them.
Well, it seems like king salmon are really pretty delicate fish to handle anyway. There's a lot of ways that hurt handling. What sort of things do people do now?
Well, they're all trying to get as many fish as they can and sell them for as much as they can. So they, you know, in the commercial season, they'll catch them, you know, like in wheels or nets. And if the weather's bad and an airplane can't pick them up, they'll throw them in the river and on a line, which in the river temperature is like 60 degrees or so. So they're better off to leave them out on the bank because maybe it'd only be 50 degrees on the bank, but it's 60 degrees in the river, and they leave them there until the airplane comes in a couple of days, and by then they're turning soft, and so they get a lot of bum fish, where, you know, if they had these ice houses or something and a place to put them, they wouldn't have that problem. Like where we're at on the Yukon, we have a little stream that comes down, and it's running, and there's ice in there until the middle of July. It glaciers up, and it's just solid ice till the middle of July, and there's water running through it. So we have a plastic pipe that we put up into that ice water, and we have an old boat down on the beach, and we have this water continually running into this boat, and the temperature of that water is like around 38 degrees. And so when we catch our fish, we throw them in this boat with the water, and it cools them down. And they'll keep in there. You know, we've never left them in there that long, but they'll keep for 2 or 3 days and be just as solid as can be in that water. But we always check our nets twice a day and bring the fish and throw them in that water and let them cool down. And it makes them easier when you're cutting strips because they're firmer. And then we leave them in there until we're ready to come to town, or the fish buyer shows up and give them to them. And there's other people along the river there that bring them down and throw them in there just because of that, because it keeps them so good there. But, you know, like everybody along that river could have one of those ice houses if they wanted to put the work into doing it. And it'd keep those fish real good until they were sold. You know, it'd keep quality fish.
To buy somebody's fish, is he pretty well committed to buying everything the guy's going to sell?
Yeah.
So they don't really inspect it to feel one fish.
No.
So it's really, you know, no economic advantage to fishermen to.
No. And that's what I've been telling these buyers. They ought to be selective about what they buy.
And then the fishermen would take better care of their fish. And if they say, I'm not going to buy that fish, you know, the next time he'll think twice before he mistreats the fish.
Or maybe he'll just get a different buyer.
Well, if the guy wants to buy it. But they're starting to get more quality control because the buyers are, you know, they know they can't sell that junk fish. So they're starting to, you know, but if anybody sells a quantity of fish to them and there's a few bad ones in, they're going to take them. And they won't, they might not sell them on the market, but they'll use them themselves or sell them to somebody that wants to can or something like that, you know, but they won't turn them on their regular market.
How about if a guy's buying them to process them, he's going to freeze them? Does it make any difference
to him? Yeah, because he's in the same boat. If he freezes a junk fish and it gets to the consumer is going to be unhappy about it. And that's what I told you about this one market that they had in Europe that went to pot.
What happened there?
Well, what they did, they had this market built up. And so they wanted to get all the fish they could get. So they went up on the Yukon and they started buying everything. And if the weather was bad for a couple of days and these guys held the fish over, they'd buy them anyway because they wanted to get them in there and get the quantity, you know. And so they hauled fish, anything they could get their hands on. And the next year they sent all these fish out. Well, when they thaw out and a guy gets a fish that cost him $60 or $70 laying in front of him and it's rotten, you know, he's pretty unhappy with it. And you can't blame him. And so the market, they just lost it. They says, no more. We don't want no more of that junk Yukon fish. And it wasn't junk to start with. They made it junk after they caught it, you know.
Well, now, you've been fishing for quite a while there in the
Yukon. Yeah.
When did you start your camp there?
Let's see, that camp I got there now, I started about, I'm not sure, about 15 years ago, I think, or 20 years ago. But I used to fish down on the Tanana before that, mostly around Nenana and between there and Minto. And I've always fished there since I was a little kid.
Always using nets?
Wheels, nets, both. Right now we have net permits because we mainly fish for kings, and you can catch a lot more kings in a net than you can in wheel and bigger ones, you know. So, and it's like for a wheel, chums, a wheel is much better because they're so hard to pull out of a net, you know, and a wheel will catch, you know, as many as you can use anyway. So you're better off with a wheel if you're using fishing chums. But like for kings, a net is better because you catch bigger ones and more fish.
Well, what is your fish camp like there on the Yukon? Who was fishing?
Well, what I'd me and Jeannie go up and fish for kings, and my son Jack, he has a wheel permit and he runs up there, and then our grandson Brooke works with us up there too, but we don't fish chums very much, you know. Once in a while we fish a few, but Jack stays up there and fishes chums, and he has a wheel going, and we just stay there through the king season now.
Do you put up a lot of fish for yourself?
Yeah, we make strips and canned a lot of fish. We can, you know, kippered fish and fresh fish and whatever we figure we'll need for the year. And we used to sell a few, but the way things go nowadays, we don't like to do it because, you know, they got so many lawsuits and like this last botulism thing and everything. We figured it just ain't worth it. And it's a lot of work. You know, you can make the same amount of money off of selling the fish fresh as you can if you smoke it and make salmon strips out of it and sell it, you know. Like we get $1 a pound for fresh fish in the round. And if you took one of those fish and made it into strips, takes you 3 weeks, you know, before they're dry, at least. You salt them, you strip them, you salt them and hang them up and dry them and take them down and take care of them. And you get $10 a pound for them. So it comes out exactly the same. You lose, you get 1/10 strips of what you got in the fishing around. So you're getting the same price as if you sold them in the round to start with and didn't do any of that work.
Well, now, has it always been easy to sell fish on Yukon? Have there always
no.
been a lot of buyers from?
No.
What's been the history of that?
Oh, it used to be, you know, it used to be hard to sell fish. Like there was, in this upper Yukon, there was just a few guys that come in and buy, you know, with airplanes. And like in the 50s and 60s, you know, like Pete Mary, and I used to go up there and buy some from different fishermen and just sell them around town here, you know. And we just sold at a local market, but most everybody either made strips out of them or just put them up for themselves. And it hadn't been just till the recent years that the real, you know, commercial buyers have been moving in there and trying to buy fish.
You mean like in the last?
Like in the last, yeah. Well, say the last, about the last 5 years. And now there's, you know, 3 or 4 buyers that operate on the upper Yukon. And sometimes they, you know, try to cut each other out by 10 cents a pound or something, but like the way we operate, we stay with the same buyer all the time, even if we get less money, because we're trying to keep him in business. And if he can't make it on that, we know that maybe these other guys are going to go down the tube and there won't be anybody. And so, you know, we don't quibble about 10 or 15 cents a pound, which amounts to money. But, you know, like Pierre Wakefield, we've been selling to for the last 3 or 4 years. And this year, there was 2 buyers moved in, and we're paying $1.10. And he says, "Well, all I can pay is $1." And he said, "I won't have no hard feelings if you sell yours to somebody else." You know. But I says, "Well, you know, you've been dealing with us this long, and so we'll go ahead and keep selling to you, even, you know, for 10 cents a pound less. You know, try to help you out and keep you in business." And that we make enough off of that, so, you know, we don't have to worry about it. So.